hello, everybody. Thank you very much for joining us. This is Digital Hammurabi. My name is Megan Lewis, for those who are joining us for the first time. And today I'm very pleased to have Dr. Patty Gerstenblith joining us. I can't tell you how thrilled I am that she's agreed to talk to us all. For those of you who aren't familiar with her, Dr. Gerstenblith is a distinguished research professor of law at DePaul University, director of DePaul's Center for Art, Museum and Cultural Heritage Law. She also served as the chair of the President's Cultural Property Advisory Committee in the U.S. Department of State from 2011 to 2017, and is the founding president of the Lawyers Committee for Cultural Heritage Preservation. She's also published widely on cultural heritage law, and she's here to talk to us today about various aspects of cultural heritage law, and specifically some questions about the Museum of the Bible. Dr. Gerstenblith also received her PhD in art history and anthropology from Harvard University, and her JD from Northwestern University. Dr. Gerstenblith, thank you so much for joining us. It's lovely to have you with us.
Thank you, Megan, for inviting me on and the opportunity to speak to you. I also want to take a moment to thank you for the introduction that you gave. It's so important that we remember what's going on in the country now. And we always have to, in whatever work we're doing, we have to bring issues of racial justice and equality to all of our endeavors. So thank you for that.
It was necessary, I think. So for those who have not joined one of our live streams before, we do take questions from the audience. Please tag me at Digital Hammurabi to make sure that I can see them. And as the little pop-up says, Super Chat questions do have priority. So if you have a burning issue that you would like addressed, that's the guaranteed way to get your questions answered. So Dr. Gerstenblith, would you mind just giving us a bit of personal background, how you got into this area of law, because it is absolutely fascinating.
Sure. So as you mentioned, I have received a PhD in Near Eastern archaeology, although I gave it an interdisciplinary approach. So I think I've always been interested in combining different disciplines together. Now, after I received my doctorate, one of my gigs, as it were, was working at the Cincinnati Art Museum. And I was presented with a question. At that time, the objects known as Lauristan bronzes had never been excavated. And Oscar Mascarella had recently published his book claiming that the Lauristan bronzes in the museums throughout the United States were forgeries. And I was given the task of determining whether the ones in the museum were authentic or not. And I realized very quickly that one really cannot determine whether something is authentic, a category, a class of artifacts, if none are known from archaeological sites, from excavations. So that was one thing that made me think about issues involving legality. The other was that there was half of a statue in the museum, and the other half was in Jordan. And it must have been one of the first examples of a country trying to at least make inquiries or efforts to recover some of their looted cultural property. So I had always been interested in going to law school, and this combined with these experiences led me to do just that. And as you said, I went to Northwestern. And eventually in the 80s, there really wasn't a field, particularly of cultural property law or cultural heritage law, at least in the United States at the time. And I like to say that the field grew up around me. Starting really in the 90s with issues involving Holocaust looted art. And that was the focus for a long time about theft of artworks. And then, of course, in the early 2000s, unfortunately, came U.S. invasion of Iraq and the looting of the museum in Baghdad and the exponential growth in the market of illegal artifacts from the Near East. Of course, that had started in the 90s with the following the 1991 Gulf War. But in the early 2000s, particularly after 2003, this just really mushroomed, as it were. And unfortunately, the situation hasn't changed. So I focus a lot of my work on specifically the trade in archaeological artifacts. And of course, I'm particularly interested in those from the Middle East, from that part of the Mediterranean where I had done my own work back as an archaeologist. So unfortunately, as the world's misfortunes have grown, so I've been able to work, or I've been required to work more and more in this field.
Lovely. Thank you very much. So I suspect there are probably some people watching who aren't entirely sure. What exactly does cultural heritage law cover?
Well, today we think of cultural heritage law as encompassing tangible heritage, so things that are physical, both immovable, so we have structures, whether it's ancient site at Palmyra or historic structures that might be religious or historic from all different time periods up to, say, the Ottoman period. Movable objects, we can think of everything from pottery, ceramics, metal, sculptures, and of course, cuneiform tablets and the like. Mm-hmm. But we also think about intangible heritage. So intangible heritage is things you don't touch. So language, practices, traditional and religious practices, and folklore, all types of things that are still part of our cultural identity. So I like to say it's everything of significance from an artistic, cultural, scientific, historical perspective mm-hmm. that you could possibly imagine. So it's really altogether cultural heritage is a very, very broad category. And the law, of course, involves both protection of cultural heritage in context. So whether it's an archaeological context, historic context, or when we think about intangible objects or intangible heritage, I should say, we can think about them operating in a cultural landscape, for example, or within a community of people. So the connection between people and heritage is an important part of what we do. So we talk about protection, we talk about preservation, and on the flip side, perhaps, is the art market, trade, how museums operate. Even we can talk about contemporary art, for example, and copyright issues, intellectual property, and things like that. So it can be a very, very broad subject as well as a somewhat narrow one.
Mm-hmm. No, it sounds it. So there's been an awful lot in the press recently, especially thinking about the Museum of the Bible, of about people illegally acquiring artifacts or acquiring artifacts not knowing that they have been removed illegally from their country of origin. A lot especially my area in Assyriology about repatriation of objects. So it seems like the acquisition of antiquities is a very, very difficult thing to navigate. If you want to legally acquire antiquities, like, what's the process? What do you do, and what do you need to be aware of to make sure that you're not tripped up by this kind of thorny problem?
Okay, so that's a big subject. I think that first of all, one needs to be aware of the legal landscape. So I think of three categories of legal issues. First is that many countries have vested ownership of archaeological objects in the country, in the nation. So, for example, Iraq passed its vesting law, its national ownership law, in 1936. So every country has enacted a vesting law at different times. I shouldn't say not every country necessarily has a vesting law, but all the countries that we think of, particularly in the Mediterranean region, tend to have such laws. And some of them go back to the early part of the 20th century. Now, it is true that there are also export restrictions, and those are in a different category from a legal perspective. I could even say, by the way, that vesting laws go back earlier into the late Ottoman period, into the late 19th century. But we tend to think of the national ownership laws as starting in the early 20th century, but every country at a different time period. And sometimes these laws need to be analyzed from a legal perspective to see whether they really are ownership laws. Mm-hmm. But if we assume that there's an ownership law in place, let's take Iraq, 1936. Something gets removed from Iraq after 1936, an archaeological artifact, without permission of the government, then that property is stolen property. Mm-hmm. And if it's brought to a country like the United States, where we have both federal and state laws that prohibit what we call trafficking, in other words, trading, transporting, storing, selling, buying, etc., stolen property. Once we know the object is considered stolen, all of those stolen property laws come into play. Mm-hmm. That's the first thing. So if you were thinking of buying an antiquity and you wanted to do it legally, the first thing you have to think about is what is the likely country of, we can say origin or discovery, but basically the place where it was dug up in modern times, not the place or it was manufactured in antiquity. But where was it dug up in modern times? Does that country have a vesting law? And if it does, was the object in the country or outside of the country before that date? Mm-hmm. So in the case of an Iraqi artifact, we'd want to know, was it out of Iraq before 1936? Which, of course, is a long time ago at this point in time. The second consideration is that, and we're going to talk about this more later, but UNESCO adopted a convention, international convention, and it's got a long name, on the means of prohibiting and preventing the illicit import, export, and transfer of ownership of cultural property. And we usually just call it the 1970 UNESCO Convention. So that was adopted by UNESCO in 1970. But what matters is not the date it was adopted, but the date that individual countries ratified it and implemented it. So those are two separate steps. Ratification is the country going through its own process that says, we want to be bound by this international convention. And then in some cases, the country also has to enact its own domestic law to put the international convention into effect.
I see.
In the case of the United States, we enacted our, although we are considered to have ratified it in 1972, depending on how you look at it, our domestic implementing legislation was enacted in 1983. Mm-hmm. We're considered to have been a state party to the convention since 1983. And again, for every country, there are now 140 countries that have ratified it. That's going to be a different date. Mm-hmm. But in the case of the United States, we made it still more complicated. And I know this is getting into the weeds. So
no, it's interesting to hear the ins and outs of it.
But the United States said, if we want to prevent the import of either archaeological or ethnological materials into the country, that country and the United States has to have an additional agreement, which is often called a bilateral agreement or an MOU, a memorandum of understanding. Now, the important part about those agreements is that the object does not have to have been documented before it is removed from the country of origin. So you all know, many of you are archaeologists, an object that is looted from the ground and transported through the international market to a destination country like the United States is not documented. Mm-hmm. It may be considered stolen under national ownership, but we don't have a documentation of its theft. So if we have a bilateral agreement, then we no longer have to prove that it was stolen. The question is only, did it leave the country of origin without an export license, without permission, after the date that the U.S. and the other country make one of these agreements. So that adds an extra layer on top of the concept of ownership. We have agreements right now, I think it's 22 countries, it might be 23. We have, the United States has been upping the number of countries in the Mediterranean. You mentioned that I chaired the Cultural Property Advisory Committee during the Obama administration. That is what this committee does, is it evaluates requests from other countries to have such an agreement and their renewal, because they have to be every 5 years. And there's a whole bunch of statutory criteria before we can have such an agreement. So that's the second option. And I'll just mention that in the case of Iraq and Syria, rather than an agreement as such, we actually have special legislation from Congress that imposed or that directed the State Department to impose these import restrictions. So we have import restrictions in place for Iraq that relate back to 1990, which was the date of the original sanctions that were imposed against Iraq when Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait. So
if it's legislature, does that mean that it doesn't have to be renewed? It stands in perpetuity?
It does not have to be renewed. The one with Iraq stands in perpetuity, unless Congress passes a new law. The one with Syria relates to 2011, and it does have a sunset provision, but it's a fairly complicated one, including a certification that the United States and Syria can now enter into one of these other agreements, normal agreement. So far, and obviously that hasn't happened as the situation in Syria, if anything, continues to get worse. Hard to imagine, but yes, it keeps getting worse. So, Iraq and Syria are unique situations, but we have bilateral agreements now with Jordan, Cyprus, Greece, Libya, Egypt, mm-hmm. Algeria, and we have pending requests from Tunisia, Morocco, Turkey. So we really anticipate, at least, that within the next year or so, much of the Eastern, really probably all of the Eastern Mediterranean, will be tied up, with the exception of Israel, which never ratified the UNESCO Convention and therefore cannot have such an agreement.
I see.
So I have to leave Israel out. Mm-hmm. So that's the second layer, is these import restrictions. The third layer is when somebody imports something into the United States, it has to be declared mm-hmm. To customs. And there are three things that need to be declared. It's country of origin, which in archaeological objects is the country of discovery. So if something comes from Iraq, you have to say it's from Iraq, mm-hmm. even if it passed through the UK or Germany or some other country. We care about where it was dug up. So country of origin, value, mm-hmm. what is it worth? And there are no import duties, no tariffs on original works of art that are more than 100 years old. So it's not for the purpose of declaring a tariff. They still have to declare its value. And third, has to be declared what it is. And those declarations all have to be truthful. So something to think about, and as we get into talking about Hobby Lobby a little more, I think this will become more apparent. But if, for example, a country like Iraq mm-hmm. is known to have national ownership, and a country like Iraq is known that we have import restrictions, if somebody wants to import something from Iraq, what are they going to do? They're not going to declare that it's from Iraq. They're going to declare it's from some other country. Mm-hmm. But then not only have they violated national ownership and the import restrictions, they now have made a false declaration to customs. So these three elements often work together. But the easiest one for the government often to use as its basis for forfeiture is the improper, the false declaration. Mm-hmm. So if I was thinking of buying an antiquity, I would have to check the national ownership laws. I'd have to check, do we have import restrictions? And third is, how was it declared upon entry into the United States? So all three of those elements need to be checked. Now, on top of that, just to make life even more complicated, is it complicated enough yet?
Right. We're guessing that.
We're getting there. Okay, well, the last one's not so complicated. But that is that people, of course, in trying to determine legality, look to what we call provenance information, because that's what we're doing. We're checking the background of the object from the time, ideally from the time it leaves the ground, to the time the potential buyer looks at the object. And the way we do that is to search backwards, really, from the object today into prior owners to see, when did it leave the country? Where did it come from? When did it leave the country? How was it imported to the United States? The problem is today, a lot of that provenance documentation is itself forgery mm-hmm. or fraudulent. So a person who is thinking of buying an antiquity not only has to worry about the legality of the object, has to worry about whether the information they're being given is accurate. And what we're seeing more and more in this field of law is that we have false provenance information accompanying authentic objects. In other areas of art, you may have fake provenance information with a fake work of art, because, of course, you use that information to create a veneer of authenticity. Mm-hmm. But in the field of archaeological artifacts, I think uniquely, we actually have fake provenance information with authentic objects. Mm-hmm. And in some cases, of course, the objects are also fake. But it's unusual to have fake provenance information with authentic objects. But we have seen that more and more, particularly, I would say, over the last close to 20 years. Mm-hmm. There was a major case that we'll probably get into more of later involving a prominent New York antiquities dealer named Frederick Schultz. And the case discusses how he and his British co-conspirator, a conservator, created fake provenance information to make it, these were artifacts from Egypt, to make it look as if they had been exported from Egypt in the 1920s and 30s, whereas in fact they were exported in the 90s. So that's another layer that if you are thinking of buying antiquities, you would need to check the legitimacy, the authenticity of the documents you're given. Now, you didn't ask me this question, but do I think it's a good idea to buy?
That was definitely going to be coming up.
Well, if you'd like me to wait, I'll wait.
No, you go for it.
Well, I think we have to think not just about the legalities. Obviously, the legalities are very complicated. And I think one reason that I like to make it seem complicated is in a way to convince people this is not something to get into easily.
Mm-hmm.
But I'll also say that unless you really, really believe that something was out of the ground and out of the country of origin back in probably the 19th century, for example, when archaeological methodology itself was in the process of formation, let's say. I think that we always have to consider that when anyone buys an antiquity on the market today, that they may be contributing directly or indirectly, knowingly, maybe unknowingly, although it's hard to know how anybody would be unknowing in this day and age, that they're contributing an incentive to looting of archaeological sites today. Large-scale acquisitions become public knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
People, looters, middlemen, smugglers, are aware of these events. They know how much these things might be worth. And even if the particular object that someone is buying is not illegal, it may have been looted, in other words, removed unscientifically from the ground, but it may not be illegal. Those are two different things. They nonetheless, I believe, are contributing, as I said, either directly or indirectly, providing a market incentive, an economic incentive for the looters, the smugglers, the middlemen to continue doing this. And mm-hmm. through looting, we have a loss of scientific information and we have loss to the communities, to the people whose heritage it is and who live among the heritage.
Mm-hmm.
So I think from both a legal perspective, because it's very fraught with legal difficulties, but also from a broader scientific knowledge, call it ethical or moral mm-hmm. perspective, we have to be aware of the incentives that might be being given mm-hmm. to encourage this activity.
One of the, we talked briefly about this with Dr. Baden last week, and one of the things that I always try, and the drive to own something that connects you to the past and to history can be very strong, but don't do it. If you would like to own a beautiful artifact that connects you to the past, own a replica. And I have a very handy shelf of replicas behind me. There are some truly fantastic artists out there working to make these stunning objects that still connect you to the history and the legacy that you are so interested in, without all of the associated destruction and looting and legal issues. So,
well, no, I agree with you. And that's actually by encouraging the arts and the craftsmanship, often again from the local communities mm-hmm. that live among the heritage, as a way of creating a sustainable economy for people so that they don't have to loot. And it's a wonderful way to acquire objects that are of great interest. I don't often quote Nancy Reagan, but I will say, just don't do it. Just say no. That's the quote. And, you know, nobody has to buy an artifact. It's interesting. Mm-hmm. If you listen to the rhetoric of people in the market, they'll be like, oh, I just had to buy it. And I wanted to try to figure out how to do it legally. Maybe I meant to do the right thing. You know, you don't have to buy it.
Mm-hmm.
There's no compulsion. And in fact, it is the buyer who ultimately has the economic power. The buyer who just says no is the buyer who, or the potential buyer, who in fact is stopping the chain that leads back to the looter.
Mm-hmm. And this kind of plays into the next question I sent, which is that buying antiquities, as you've highlighted, is problematic, generally speaking. But that it seems as though at the moment the purchase of antiquities from the Middle East is particularly prominent in the news. We've seen several, I think three this year, instances just from the Museum of the Bible. why is that?
Well, I think, first of all, we have to acknowledge the massive amount of looting that has happened in Iraq since the 90s, not only immediately after the 1990-91 war, but the sanctions that were put on Iraq for roughly a decade that created not only additional poverty amongst people, but also limited the actions that the government could take to protect, to guard archaeological sites. And we know that objects were looted from museums early in the 90s, and some of those have shown up in the United States. Some of them showed up in the early 2000s. That, in fact, have been documented by the University of Chicago, by the Oriel Institute. So we have looting going back through the 90s. The looting of archaeological sites in 2003, in a couple of months after, you know, from about March until at least the summer 2003, and maybe going as late as 2008. If you, Dr. Elizabeth Stone has studied, she was one of the first people to use the aerial photography, satellite imagery to document the looting. Massive amounts of archaeological material was looted in southern Iraq over that period. There were estimates going up to 500,000 objects being looted from sites, particularly in southern Iraq at that time, which, of course, is the source of many of the particularly cuneiform tablets, cylinder seals, and the like that started showing up in the market around 2007, 2008. Dr. Neil Brody at Oxford and others have been documenting the appearance of these objects on the market beginning in roughly that time period. Now it's all compounded by the looting in Syria that went on since 2011. And yes, a lot of publicity was given to the looting carried out by the so-called Islamic State, but we have to acknowledge that all the parties to the conflict, not just the Islamic State, was engaged in this looting, particularly, I think, the Assad regime, probably some of the other rebel groups as well. So this level of instability, political instability, chaos, is the perfect ingredient for looting. And we see this going on in places like Libya. We see it going on in Yemen today. Every place where there is a breakdown of political order, of the ability to regulate, to protect sites, to protect museums, and to regulate the market always leads to the same chaotic situation, which is perfect for looting. Mm-hmm. So these objects also are obviously very important on the market. It was pointed out that there was a sale, I think it was in the late 80s, of something called the Erlenmeyer Collection of Mesopotamian artifacts. And they were legal, mm-hmm. I guess, or they are reported to have been legally acquired. But they went for very high values. And I will also say in the early 2000s, for example, Christie's sold one cylinder seal for over $400,000. And again, it may be technically legal. I didn't see the provenance information. Mm-hmm. But that's a lot of money, actually, for one cylinder seal. Cuneiform tablets would go on the market for easily roughly, I would say, $2,000, sometimes less in London or New York. So you have a combination of a market. Obviously, these artifacts are desirable to collectors. They're interesting. They have a lot of significance. You have the chaos on the ground. You have the continuous publication of these kinds of objects by scholars. In both Europe and the United States. You have their publication by the Cornell series, which I would imagine many of the listeners are familiar with, which is notorious. And yet it goes on.
Still happens.
So we have collaboration by scholars, particularly in the field of texts, where many scholars who study texts do not feel constrained by the issues of loss of context, because they would say everything you need to know is on the tablet itself. We don't need to know where the tablet came from. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, gets into another discussion, but archaeological context is important, not only to archaeology, but to text scholars also. So I think we have a perfect storm of chaos on the ground and the market and desirability of these objects and proof mm-hmm. of their marketability and relatively high value. Mm-hmm. And I guess the last ingredient would be organization like the Museum of the Bible, or perhaps more appropriately, the Hobby Lobby Corporation, which is mm-hmm. the buyer of most of, maybe all of the artifacts. They created, in a very short period of time, a large collection, the willingness to spend a lot of money. And I do believe that one buyer can, in fact, influence or make a market. So they started in 2009, as far as I'm aware, buying actually manuscripts mm-hmm. that were not archaeological artifacts, but that they influenced the market just with one purchase through an auction house, I think it was through Sotheby's, where they were willing to pay very high value. And that, of course, influences what other people are doing.
Mm-hmm.
So all of those elements together has made the Middle East a source. We shouldn't lose sight not only of places that are maybe not technically in the Middle East, like Yemen, but, for example, following the earthquake in Nepal, you have a similar kind of situation, much less attention being paid. You have places with armed conflict like Cambodia from the 70s and the 80s, where things were looted through government and military forces that were complicit in it. So the Middle East is not the only place where this is happening, but it happens to be the place right now where a lot mm-hmm. of focus.
Yeah. And something that there's a question that's being asked in the chat, which I think is quite pertinent to the conversation at the moment. What are the consequences for auction houses who knowingly sell or suspect that the objects they are selling do not have legitimate provenance? I'm thinking particularly of the Gilgamesh dream tablet, which was determined recently to have been removed from Iraq. I think they said before, like 2000 or 2008.
Well, the first, the government complaint, the first mention of the tablet mm-hmm. was 2001.
Okay, 2001.
So it predated the 2003 war, but obviously postdated the 1990 war and the looting that went on in the 90s. So mm-hmm. one might suspect it was looted in the 90s, but of course we don't really know. Well, an auction house or a dealer, well, I'm going to back up a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
There's a big difference between if we speak legally for a moment again, then we can talk about ethically. But legally speaking, most of these actions, legal actions, the government has filed to recover objects are called civil forfeiture.
Mm-hmm.
So civil forfeiture is an action actually against the property. So, for example, the title, if any of you looked at the complaint, is United States versus, I think it's one Gilgamesh dream tablet or something.
Yeah.
The other is United States versus, 3,500
cuneiform tablets. Yeah.
Whatever. So it's the property that is the defendant.
Mm-hmm.
Which is kind of curious. But civil forfeiture is a means by which the government can take away property that in some way is illegal. So there's a difference between civil forfeiture, which is domestic in the United States, and civil forfeiture, which involves something brought in across the border. So I'm only going to talk about those that come in from abroad. And in those cases, what the government has to prove is a very low level of proof. The initial burden of proof on the government is what's called probable cause, which is a very low level. And even the elements of the government has to prove are relatively low. But most importantly, depending on some of the complications, and I'm going to try not to get into those complications, mm-hmm. but in some of those forfeiture actions, they don't even have to prove that someone today or the current possessor knew anything about the object being illegal. So when the government files a forfeiture for the Gilgamesh tablet, they don't have to prove that Hobby Lobby knew it was illegal. They don't have to prove that Christie's knew it was illegal. They don't have to prove any of that stuff. And what they do have to prove is a pretty low level of proof. So it's a relatively easy. I get into trouble when I say this to government lawyers because nothing is ever simple. But compared to other things. In the grand scheme of things, it's relatively easy. Contrast that with a criminal prosecution. So if the government were to go after a dealer, a collector, a museum curator, whatever, for criminal prosecution, to put them in prison, they have to prove that the person knew or intended at least the acts that were illegal, and that the government's burden of proof is one of beyond a reasonable doubt. It's a very, very high standard. So it's very difficult when you're dealing with something that is four or five or six or whatever steps removed. Because remember, these objects are rooted from the ground, and they go to probably one smuggler, and they get them out of the country, and then they go through several other dealers, and then finally they show up in the United States. This gives the person in the United States what we can call plausible deniability. They can say, I didn't know. How was I supposed to know?
Especially if it has forged provenance paperwork,
You know, maybe I didn't do my provenance, but that doesn't mean I knew. Okay. Now, I will say that in this case involving this dealer called Schultz, the court did use a jury instruction based on what's called conscious avoidance. So if somebody intentionally avoids learning the facts because they basically know that the facts would lead to the knowledge that it's illegal, then the jury can infer that the knowledge element. But that still is a difficult thing to establish. So in the United States, so Mr. Schultz was prosecuted in 2001, went to prison in 2003. So that's 17 years ago. There hasn't been, there have been some criminal actions since that time, but no dealer or prominent dealer, no collector, no museum official has gone to prison in the United States. There have been a few prosecutions that have ended, you know, in kind of like settlement agreements. No one has gone to prison since then for antiquity smuggling. And no curator or collector has been prosecuted in the United States, at least not for antiquities from the Mediterranean. So what's the responsibility of an auction house? Obviously, the first responsibility of an auction house is not to commit a crime. But committing the crime requires knowledge. So they're going to get away pretty easily on that. Now, the way an auction house and a dealer, if the dealer is working on consignment, dealers typically, we think of dealers as buying the object and then reselling it. But it doesn't have to be that way. Auction houses sell on consignment. They don't own the things that they sell. Somebody else owns it, and they're selling it on behalf of the owner. They typically today will get a, they will sign an agreement between the auction house and the consigner where the consigner warrants to the auction house that they have good title and whatever other facts are involved. Now, in the case of the Dream Tablet, the consigner, we don't know exactly what the consignment agreement said. The consigner, I think this is probably one of the most interesting parts of the case. The signer said, or the Christie's actually went back, not just to the consigner, but to the original dealer, original U.S. antiquities dealer, and said, you know, how good is this provenance information you're giving us? Now, we know now that this provenance information was fake, at least according to the government complaint. They said it had a 1981 provenance, which predated the import restrictions from 1990, although it did not predate the Iraqi ownership law. But they went back to 1981 with the false provenance information. But Christie's went back to that dealer and said, well, you know, basically, how reliable is your provenance information? And the dealer said something like, well, it's not going to hold up to public scrutiny. Doesn't mean they told Christie's that it was false, but they said it's not going to hold up. Now, what did Christie's? And we all normally think of auction houses selling things publicly, right? They put out a glossy, beautiful auction catalog. Nowadays, you can get those catalogs on the internet. Wonderful. What we don't always realize is that auction houses also do a lot of private sales. Sometimes they're called private treaty sales. So roughly 20% of auction house business today, and maybe more at this point, are these private sales. So what did Christie's do? It decided to sell the tablet privately rather than publicly because they knew
that wouldn't be this.
Right. That it wouldn't hold up. So it didn't mean that they refused to sell it. Oh, no, no, no. We're still going to sell it.
just more quietly.
Right. We're just going to pick a different business model. different method of sale, where it's less likely to get public scrutiny. And I think this is an important point, because people think, oh, auction houses, they're all public, you know, they're not going to do anything obviously illegal. Well, no. It just changes the way they go about selling it. Mm-hmm. To me personally, again, I can't say that this is, certainly I can't say that it's a crime. I think it's unethical. Mm-hmm. But then again, ethics don't really apply. There's no source of ethics. Mm-hmm. Many institutions have codes of ethics, voluntary guidelines, museums, the archaeological organizations, whatever. The auction houses don't have a code of ethics. Some Christie's and Sotheby's have voluntarily adopted, and we'll talk a little more about the 1970 date. Mm-hmm. They say that they have adopted a date that they would require the provenance information to go back to. Christie's, it's a little bit unclear. They use maybe 2000, maybe they use earlier. But in this case, it doesn't really seem that they did that. And more importantly, they relied on provenance information that they themselves knew was not reliable. Mm-hmm. And of course, the other part of the case is now Hobby Lobby is suing Christie's.
Because they knew the provenance would not hold up.
Right. Well, in every sale is implied what's called a warranty of title. So Christie's would have automatically warranted to Hobby Lobby that it could convey good title, which of course they couldn't. Mm-hmm. So that was breached. There may be complications to Hobby Lobby's ability to recover. The other allegation is fraud. So for fraud, they would have to prove that Christie's knew at the time of the sale that the information they were giving was not accurate. Mm-hmm. And my guess is that, assuming that this gets into a full court case, which I don't know if it will. I mean, they may well work out some kind of an agreement. But if it gets into a full court case, much of the discussion will be Christie's commit fraud at the time that it gave whatever documentation they gave to Hobby Lobby.
Fascinating. Do you think that legislation which regulates auction houses needs changing?
Well, I don't think there is any legislation, at least in the United States.
That's useful.
I mean, there is general law mm-hmm. out there, both in the U.S. and the U.K. For example, I said in the United States, into every sale of goods of any kind mm-hmm. is implied a warranty of title. That's a product of legislation, something in the United States called the Uniform Commercial Code, which is adopted by 49 of the 50 states. And you have similar things in the U.K. So that already exists as a matter of general law. Mm-hmm. The thing that would make a difference, I think, it would be two lines of legislation that maybe come together. One is there have been attempts in the United States to bring the art market within what's called the Bank Secrecy Act, which has to do with money laundering. The art market is perfect for money laundering, I should say, because there's no established value of what an object is. So somebody mm-hmm. can buy an artwork, and this is not just an antiquity, any painting, whatever, for one value, move it to another country, sell it for a higher value, whatever, and it's a way of passing money from country to country mm-hmm. Funds. And of course, today there's also the use of what are called free ports, where you can put artwork for decades, never pay any taxes, no documentation, et cetera. But anyway, to get back to Roberta's question. So I think that bringing the art market within these kinds of regulations where they have to report all their transactions above a certain amount of money, in the U.S., I think it's $10,000, mm-hmm. which involves what's called know your customer. So they would need to verify who not only their clients are, but who the buyer is. And they would have to maintain records. And that's kind of the second part, is whether as part of that or separately, there needs to be an obligation for dealers, not just auction houses. We have to really not just focus on one or the other. They mm-hmm. both have to be regulated. They should have to be required to keep records of their transactions, who their buyers are, who their sellers are, whether the buyers and sellers are basically legitimate, their sources of funds are legitimate, mm-hmm. and that those records have to be available for public inspection. Now, I will say in the United States, the political climate is such, this isn't going to happen. You know, we have moved far away from regulation of all kinds of industries. And we'd also in the United States have to deal with the question, is it federal regulation or is it done individually state by state?
Mm-hmm.
Because traditionally this would be a state function, not a federal function. But of course, the art market is cross-border and cross-state border. So it could be federal regulation. I just don't see it happening.
Mm-hmm.
In the UK, maybe the political climate is somewhat different. I'm not sufficiently familiar to see whether the EU has adopted in recent years this kind of what we call the bank secrecy stuff that from a money laundering perspective is being applied to the art market. I think the situation in the UK is difficult because of Brexit.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know what legislation was adopted pursuant to EU regulation the UK is going to maintain or have to reenact. So that needs to be seen.
Thank you. So going back briefly to the UNESCO 1970 agreement, can you explain just in a little bit more detail exactly what that is and why it's relevant for what we're talking about?
Okay. So are you talking about the convention or the date?
Yes. Sorry, the convention.
The convention is relevant because it sets up a system by which countries that ratify it are supposed to restrict the import of not just archaeological material, but all kinds of cultural property. So it includes all kinds of artworks, ethnographic objects, obviously, you know, numismatics, all kinds of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And many countries, most countries, exception of the United States and Switzerland, automatically restrict the import of cultural objects that have left their country of origin illegally. So if, I'll stick with Iraq. Iraq has export restrictions in place. It says these kinds of artifacts, you know, something predating 1700, cannot leave the country without an export license. If you are in Germany, if you are in Canada, Australia, any number of countries, those objects cannot come into the country automatically without an export license from Iraq, if it left Iraq after the date that all these countries ratified the convention. And this is part of the problem because every country's ratified the convention at a different date, still at this point. And that system works pretty well for undocumented objects. I mean, the biggest challenge is, as I said before, objects that are looted directly from the ground have no documentation. We don't know much about them. We can't look at a catalog. We can't look at the ICOM red list and say, aha, we know that that object was in Iraq on a certain date or whatever. So by requiring that an export restriction, an export license be shown. So in Germany, for example, which has a really excellent law, it is the burden of the importer to produce an export license. And if they don't produce an export license, there is a presumption that the object left the country after the date the German legislation went into effect.
I see.
So to me, this is really an excellent way of going. Unlike the United States and actually also Switzerland, which require these additional agreements on top of everything else.
Mm-hmm.
So the U.S. system just makes it a lot more complicated.
The United States left UNESCO last year. Could this affect the application of these kinds of protocols?
No. Fortunately, no. We remain, the United States was not a member of UNESCO from the mid 80s until I think it was 2004. And then we rejoined, for about 10, 15 years. We'd stopped funding UNESCO in 2011 because they had admitted Palestine as a state, as a member state. When we stopped funding and paying our dues, we lost our vote about 2 or 3 years after that. So our withdrawal was actually relatively unimportant. What was important was losing our vote, I would say. Mm-hmm. But as a party to these conventions, that does not change.
Wonderful. Thank you. Can Hobby Lobby argue fraud considering that they willfully ignored the lack of provenance of the artifacts that they were buying?
So I think the Gilgamesh tablet is a little bit different in that when you buy from a Christie's or a Sotheby's, which are considered to be the top of the market, and they have a lot of resources for doing provenance research, I think it may be reasonable to rely on provenance information that you're given in that circumstance. This is very different than what happened in the objects that were forfeited, that were seized, I should say, in 2010, 2011, forfeited in 2017, where you're buying from dealers that are, I'll say, shady, under very shady circumstances. And there seem to have been more objects that were acquired in about 2014, so around the time of the Good Blemish Tablet, which also seemed to have come from dealers. The museum announced in March that it was returning another 6,500 objects to Iraq and 5,000 to Egypt. Mm-hmm. We don't know a lot about the background of those objects, but, you know, it's a very different thing to go to the UAE, sit on the floor with a bunch of tablets and other bullae and all that spread out on some table or whatever, and buy with, not only with provenance documentation, which is so absurd. No rational person could have believed it. You know, the provenance documentation they were given in those 2010 purchases said that the objects had been in the United States and then taken out of the United States and brought to the UAE for a U.S. buyer to inspect.
That would raise some questions.
Sense. Because the toughest part, if you're in the market, the toughest part is getting those objects into the United States. They've been in the United States since the 70s or the 80s or whatever. You don't take them out. Mm-hmm. You don't have to know anything about the antiquities market to know that that statement was absurd. That's very different from buying from a Christie's, which says to you, oh, we have documentation.
We have it. Yeah.
One, I don't know that there's a requirement to act reasonably. In other words, I don't know that in order to act reasonably, one then has a requirement to go beyond that, as opposed to relying on somebody or an entity that is supposedly is reputable. I always have to put air quotes around the word reputable. So it's two totally different kinds of things.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Related to that, actually, is our next question. For those who don't know, Dr. Gerstenblith consulted for the Green family who founded the Museum of the Bible right at the beginning of their collecting activities. And from what I've read, you told them basically that anything acquired from Iraq carried a risk. They obviously went ahead with these purchases anyway and have made several other acquisitions that are either illegal or fraudulent. Based on your interactions with them and with the information that has come out subsequently, do you think they were acting just with great deal of naivety, or just they didn't think they would get caught?
Okay, well, one thing I want to make clear, as you refer to me as doing consulting for them, the government documents refer to somebody as the consultant. That's not me.
Oh, my apologies.
That's Scott Carroll.
Okay.
And I want to make really clear, everybody who's listening, I am not the consultant, because
thank you.
Consultant did is in a very different category. And Scott Carroll worked for them for several years.
I see.
My interaction was, my personal interaction was one thing. I did go to Oklahoma City. I did run a little kind of seminar similar to what I said here earlier when I went through all the different legal parameters. And then I wrote a summary of that, and I sent it to them. So now I didn't find out until 2017 when I read the government complaint where this is discussed. The in-house lawyer at Hobby Lobby never distributed my summary to anybody else within the corporation. And it does seem as if maybe this is a plausible deniability sort of setup.
Thing. I see.
Where nobody, you know, it looks like nobody has complete information as to what's happening. But I want to point out, in addition to what I told them, earlier that summer, in July of 2010, Steve Green was, according to the government complaint, Steve Green brought back to the United States a Bible. I think he had purchased it for $1 million. He was stopped by customs because he didn't declare it. And they let him keep the Bible and bring it in, but they gave him a little sort of primer on, oh, you need to declare things
when
you bring them into the country. And later, after my involvement with them, when they started actually bringing these objects in, so Hobby Lobby is a major importer of objects, you know, of materials that they use that they sell in their craft stores. Mm-hmm. And they have their own international shipping office. And they went to their internal office and said, we're going to be bringing these objects in. Would you arrange it? And they normally use with a customs broker, which is the typical way things are brought into the country. And they went to the customs broker, and the customs broker said, essentially, you know, you can't do this. If you say these things are from Iraq, they're going to get stopped. Mm-hmm. So instead of listening to their customs broker and their own internal shipping department, they went and then turned back to the dealers in the Middle East, in Israel, and UAE, and said, okay, you guys ship it in for us. You handle the paperwork. And it was, to me, it was clearly a way of avoiding their own processes that were set up to mm-hmm. ensure legality. So I know that was a long way of answering your question.
I have virtually no doubt though.
That they knew that what they were doing was evading the law. Mm-hmm. They knew it was illegal. I know they keep saying, oh, we were naive, we relied on the wrong people, and all this kind of stuff. Okay, well, they were advised by some bad people. But I have to say, in my personal opinion, they were also advised by some good people. And they chose to, you know, and as I said, it wasn't just me.
Yeah.
But they chose to ignore all of that. And I think it was because they thought they would get away with it. Mm-hmm. And quite honestly, many of us who study the market believe that the quantity of objects that come into the United States is far, far higher. Mm-hmm. What the government manages to intercept is probably a tiny tip of the iceberg. So the odds are they would have gotten away with it. But it just seems like, from what I can tell reading through the complaint, that some careful people at the FedEx Center in Nashville became suspicious mm-hmm. and contacted law enforcement. Mm-hmm. So you can get away with an awful lot, in my opinion. I hate to admit that publicly because I don't want to give anyone any ideas.
Yeah.
But I would guess it falls much more on the side of, yeah, they thought they could get away with it than they were taken advantage, they were naive or they were taken advantage of or whatever.
Something that Dr. Baden said in our interview last week was that they keep giving the same excuses and the same apology each time. And at some point that excuse and that apology ceases to mean anything because you did know better. You've been told publicly by many people.
Right. When you think about if they're buying more objects, and not necessarily the Gilgamesh tablet, but if you're buying more objects, let's say in 2014 or so, you already know that the government has seized that first batch, mm-hmm. the 2010, 2011 batch. So you know the government has already seized your stuff. Why do you keep doing it? I mean, that part is astounding to me.
Dr. Gerstenberg, thank you for joining me. This was eminently fascinating as someone with absolutely no legal background or understanding of the law. Thank you for making it very clear for me. I appreciate that.
Well, thank you for your interest in the subject.
Oh, no, it was wildly fascinating. Until next time, resist poor scholarship. Always ask, how do you know that?